Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I've been asked to give a Dhamma talk tonight. My name is Sona. I'm from Birken Monastery, Canada. I spent the last 3 months, the rains, in West Virginia at the Bhavana Society. Very interesting experience for me. That's where I was ordained over 20 years ago. And I left for Thailand in 1990. And so at the request of my teacher, Bhante Gunaratna, I was asked to come and help out. He was on retreat for a year, and so he wouldn't be there. But he thought it would be good to have an extra body-mind available. So I arrived back after 20 years. It was a bit like the Odyssey. 20-year circle. Very interesting to see structures. And a very positive experience. Dreamlike in some ways. I kept thinking that I had possibly gone to sleep there and taken a nap in one of the kutis and woken up. Only dreamed that I had gone off to Thailand and etc. Because much of the nature hadn't changed at all. The trees, the oak forest there had not changed. Some of the buildings hadn't changed. And some of the people there were the same, but they were 20 years older. It was a great opportunity reflecting on anicca. I didn't expect to be back. It was also a great opportunity to reflect on gratitude and obligations. Since I was given ordination by Bhante Gunaratna and given my early training, received in a very cordial manner, and the slender resources that were available at time were shared, and I shared mine. Mine were limited to mostly just physical abilities, not much in the way of skills. I actually was trained as a classical musician, so I arrived there and it wasn't of very much use. So I had to learn to build buildings instead, which I did, which is a very turned out to be a very interesting experience. And I got to look at some of these buildings, however crude they were, still standing after 20 years. So, in fact, the obligations, the loyalty, and the, you know, considerations for one's teacher was a very interesting part of that. I have my own monastery to run in Canada, and I was very fortunate to have Ajahn Sudanto and Karuna Damo volunteer to replace me up there, and I think it was good for my monastery as well. And so fresh energies moving around and feeling, nice feeling to be able to do something for somebody who had taught me some very important lessons in life. Some of the things that I've been doing lately in the last few years, one of them which is becoming more interesting to me is spending time with people who have terminal illnesses, such as cancer, particularly cancer. And I think if you're an abbot or a senior monk, it's pretty well going to be handed to you. That's one of the rampant, almost epidemic facts of life in America, cancer, and its frightening possibilities. It's very interesting to reflect how to handle that. I think a few years ago, I might have given, and I've heard other monks give standard, you know, sort of pat replies to people when they tell them that they have cancer, kind of take the almost scriptural sort of attitude of, well, you know, everything's impermanent. Or even, you know, yes, we're all going to die, that kind of thing. And I thought, well, I don't know, I wonder if there's anything more that we can say than that. Sometimes that sounds rather unsympathetic. Maybe not that. I mean, I think for certain, when certain monks say it, maybe from great old age or a certain tone of voice, sometimes it really does work and really does communicate. And I think if the monk is younger and healthy and not in the same situation, it's a little bit lacking to just tell them to be equanimous. So I've considered and reflected, what can you say, what can you do for somebody who's facing this announced death sentence in a limited period of time? So I did, and I've given a number of talks about it as well. So the more I thought about it, what I realized is that people in hospices, or people who have, you know, theoretically a year to live or something like this, are thought to be dying. And I kept reflecting on the certainties of life: old age, sickness, death, loss. And, of course, a responsibility in the midst of that, that is, your inheritance will be the moral dimension of your actions. The five certainties. But amongst those, I see no dying. I see death, I see illness, I see aging, but I don't see dying. And that is hospices and so forth are for the dying. You can't get in there if you're not going to die in a certain specified period of time. Get kicked out if you don't die soon enough. It is true. You have up to a year, and then you have to move on if you don't die. I have a lay friend of mine that had been a steward for some time, and that was what he did. He was a lay practical nurse, and he worked in the hospice. And so I got to hear a lot of stories and go and visit the hospice. And there's a very strange atmosphere in hospices. Some people are quite healthy. They have a terminal illness, but it doesn't necessarily show. And so there's all kinds of a range of people in the hospice. And it's not a hospital. So not very different. And people who come to visit them are coming to visit the dying, and the staff who are there are taking care of the dying. But the more I thought about dying, the more it disappeared on me. I couldn't define it. What is it to be dying? I know what to be dead is. But the more I reflected on it, the more I couldn't define what the difference between the staff and the patients was, or the visitors, or me and them. I realized after a while that dying is identical to living. That is what they're synonymous terms. They are actually identical. That birth is the beginning of dying. It's also the beginning of living. So that the two terms, as verbs, they're moving, they're changing, they're a process, which are identical. So living is dying, because it always inevitably and certainly ends in death. So the issue is not any longer that they are at all in any way different. And part of what my first difficulty was trying to come up with advice, special advice for people who are dying. And after I examined the issue long enough, I realized, why I was having trouble coming up with anything. Because there's nothing there to come up with. They are living, just like everybody else. And they're not special. It's exactly what we are all doing. There's no special dimension to it. So I say, what do I say to the living? What do I say to the ordinary people? It's more or less what then I sat down with people who have terminal cancer and I began to talk to them just like I would talk to anybody. That about the situation they're in is nothing. They're not in any special situation. And the more they, what the anxiety comes up with is the attempt to grapple with, you know, preparing for death or etc. Then I had to reflect on what death is. And then I drew a blank again. It's something that, it's not something that you could conceive of. If it is such a thing as death, if there is such a thing as death, as annihilation, well, then there's nothing to think about. And it's notoriously difficult to think about nothing. It's an unthinkable, incomprehensible, because we've never experienced it. We have no logic to speak about it. So it can be set aside, any contemplation, any worthwhile contemplation about the possibility that death is some sort of annihilation is simply not worth thinking about. And you can set it aside that there is no difference between living and dying, so the things, the ordinary things you think of when you're living are appropriate to think of when you're dying. They're identical. So the only thing I could come up with is like how to set aside the option that death is annihilation altogether and only to prepare for continuance. But continuance, uncertainty. Death seems to be a radical change, at least the body we can see directly in front of us drops away. So I had to go back and meditate on some passages. The Dhammapada is good for this. You know? The Buddha says, you are to travel to a far land. What will you take with you? So that's the sense of we're not sure what's going to happen. He's challenging it as, you know, what will you take with you? Obviously, the physical dimension is unavailable. But this is a non-voluntary voyage that you must take. You are to travel like immigrants to a place you've never been before, and you're not sure how it's going to be. You've heard stories. So what we're left with there is the only thing we can have any reference to is the experience of our life. And that experience we have to draw, and we have now the sobering reality that although, yes, you are dying, living, just like you always were, the date is approaching perhaps more rapidly than you had anticipated. The voyage is about to begin sooner than you thought. So at that point, I think person is very open to more or less the heart issues, the emotions. And that's where I think we can do something. Mostly I sit and let them talk, and I just reflect back the same things I say to people every day in Dhamma talks, question and answer periods and so forth, the same kind of thing. But I just try to encourage them to talk about meaning. What were the meaningful moments in your life? And soon they come to the realization of what's important in life. You know, the quality of the heart, friendship, love, fearlessness. Before I left, there was a woman I met just happened to step out of a retreat. There was a, when I arrived at Bhavana Society, there was a retreat being given by a Burmese or Malaysian nun, had been trained by Pa Ok Sayadaw. Was Sayale Susila, giving one of the fairly demanding kind of jhana retreat. I was a guest monk, so I could take a retreat while the retreat was going on. When I just caught them emptying out of the retreat, some of them looking rather shell-shocked rather than jhanic, but rubbing their knees. One woman I just happened to strike up a conversation with, and it wasn't more than a sentence into it, and she told me, I've got cancer, I'm here, and it doesn't look good. So that began the conversation, and so I said, well, just, come out and talk. So we had many conversations. And in just that allowance of to be heard and to steer, that's very important, of course, in our living. This is what I feel is touching, in a sense, in life, is that as I look around, as in a reference to becoming a monk, one of my early ideas about being a monk was solitude, and this is a strange change from my earlier years as a musician, where the musician usually wants to have an audience. And then as I become into spiritual practice, I sought more solitude as a layperson. I even became a hermit. And then when I became a monk, I found that I was actually surrounded by a lot of interested and caring people, and that I interacted with them in a way that was almost unknown in ordinary life. So, and in some ways, I think for most people, to be acknowledged by another is to exist. And that's what when I look at lay people who are leading busy, interactive lives, for many of them, what's missing in some ways is the somebody actually aware, fully aware, cognizant of their existence before they die. To be sit in a room, because it comes to my attention, the more I practice mindfulness, that when I sit with lay people in a room and observe a conversation, hear a conversation, that they're not talking to each other. It's very rare to have a conversation, a dialogue, where they're responding to each other. They tend to be telling, two people having a monologue, and possibly a television going at the same time. The horror of this television business relates to the hospice as well. One of my friend Bo, who works at the hospice, said, when I went around to the hospice, I said, there's television in every room. He says, I know, it's really... And he doesn't have a television at home. As he works, like the night shift in the hospice, the television's going all the time. And he said, it's... Most of them die with the television on. I said, God, that's eerie. That's weird. He says, it is... But their relatives are there, and they're all really uncomfortable with this. And the television is very awkward to turn the television off at that point. It's just too stone silent, and nobody knows what to say. So the television is on in the background, but it's the Wheel of Fortune or something like this, a game show. It's a horrible kind of atmosphere. But this is what we live with. This is our living, and this is what our dying is as well. The triviality, we throw it away. We don't really acknowledged. So people quite often, I see people walking down the street, I think this person probably would like to be acknowledged before they die, you know, that they exist. And that how they get that is by somebody actually sees that person in front of them, pays attention, listens to them, fully sees them, engages with them. And that's one of the things that that person who is close to dying, close to death, sorry, not close to dying, but close to death, is helpful. And if you take that into your, you'll all have the opportunity, I'm sure, to come close to this experience and to feel natural. Because people also come to the monastery who go and take care of people in hospice, and they want to know what did I say, what should I do, this and that. So there's really nothing. It's ordinary. It's just they are just living people. But what we do is we neglect to acknowledge fully the presence of a living being, and how you come into existence is through that another living being fully aware, fully acknowledging. So what we're looking for in relationship as well, we're so distracted. So it's quite it's a very rich, enjoyable experience to be fully present with somebody, you know, without a TV going. And you don't have to wait till somebody has been told that they only have a year left. Because everybody you meet is dying. I remember reading a phrase about some turned-on evangelical preacher. He said, "I preached as a dying man to dying men." And, of course, that's the condition that we're all in. So I realize I'm in the same position as they are, dying. So I talk to them in the sense that all things are, you know, the trivialities of life are not important for this very moment of interaction. In terms of the scale of possibilities in human life, this could be one of the best, just to be with. I know some of these people are strangers to me, but at the same time, these core human values are universal. So sometimes they haven't had any exposure to Buddhism at all. And what I usually try to get them to go towards is move towards a sense of being out of control. That they're in a state that most people want to get things under control. They want some sort of ways to control life, and that's where anxiety and fear comes up. And that they have to move strangely in the opposite direction, just to let go of the desire to get this under control, because it really is out of control. But at the same time, to feel cool and at ease with this out-of-control situation. People wake up in the middle of the night, you know, and they feel out of control. Everything's out of control. But this is the essence of the Buddha's teaching on anatta, this truth, which is pervading our whole life right in front of us, but at the same time we're in deep denial. We're always pursuing control, command over the body, a false sense of control over the body. And of course he points out that if the body was yours or worthy of being called you or yours, you could control it. You could tell it not to be sick and it would do that. But it isn't. It's out of control. But that's the blessing, is that if you can get to that realization that it's not only out of control, it's not you, then you feel relieved from this burden, this futile attempt to manage things, control things that are not possible to do. And that when you realize that this body is run by biological principles, that the sense of relief comes from this. People who have never been exposed to this at first, sometimes they find it kind of almost a bizarre sense of humor or something, and maybe resentful. But I tell them to just Just think about it. And since they are in a tight corner and nobody else has much to say of anything except tippy-toe around it or burst into tears, so they quite often, after they can hear that for a while, they start to see how profoundly important it is. One man that I talked to, his wife was a meditator, and he had never had any interest in this, but he went to the doctor one day, and the doctor came out and said, "You got a year to live." So he's, you know, maybe 40, he's got two kids, a wife, and so on. So, yes, shocking. So his wife brought him up, because his mother didn't know what to say, and his father didn't know what to say, and his brothers didn't know what to say, and she didn't know what to say, and so maybe I knew what to say. So anyway, I taught him this phrase, you know, "Don't worry, everything's out of control." And he ended up getting it tattooed on his arm. Because sometimes when you're having some chemo, you get forgetful and so forth. But if it's tattooed on your arm, at least you can hold on to that. You find that very, very something to give him some solace, some freedom, some lightness. And so he's been benefiting from it. Now it's almost 3 years, still alive. It's all uncertain. It's all out of control. Even that death sentence is out of control. So this, you know, can be very profitable. The intensity, the realization, you know, most people, we're talking this way all the time, really. The Dhamma is talking this way all the time. The Buddha is saying, you know, you are, your life is so uncertain, like it can gone any time, you know. You never know, it's completely out of control. But it's very hard to get that feeling and make it real unless you have a near-death experience. I had one just on the way to the airport at Washington, D.C., on the highway there, freeway. Three of us driving back in a Beetle, in a Volkswagen Beetle, and a truck pulled out, just careening across both lanes, and the driver happened to be sort of looking out this way, and I managed to get his attention just in time. We right over onto the shoulder and just managed to get around this. Whoa, yes. The two other guys in the car were people that I'd known more than 20 years ago. They'd been practicing for my 25 years. And so it was very, you know, it was actually a very dharmic experience. It was interesting to see the practice really pay off as well. It was like, yeah, anytime. So the essence of this is that, you know, the richness that comes from the recognition that we are all in the same situation. There's a beauty in being able to sit with people who are so-called dying and not have the TV on. And also to sit with people haven't been told they're going to die in a year without the TV on. We can possibly, of course it takes two to do that, you know. Maybe they won't appreciate it if you turn the TV off and say, "Now we're just going to sit here and talk without that TV on." They may not appreciate that, but the more you reflect on this, your mortality and the fact that we are dying one way or the other, the beauty of life, the beauty of the emotions of loving kindness, true friendship, just come up. So I feel it's very privileged to have somebody who has that whiff of mortality. They tend to be very sincere, open to things. They're afraid sometimes too, and that's a privilege to be there and to be able to share that. this woman that I had started to talk about, a very brave woman, very accomplished as well, a professor of literature and so forth, a kayaker, a whitewater kayaker, all these things. In her 50s, and she diagnosed with terminal cancer. And she said her whole life was about gutting it out. She's like, why? How would she get her PhD and so forth, which is tough. She was tough, enduring. But it's starting to wear her down. She'd been told she had a lot less time than, and she really, she was way beyond her expiry date. And it was just because sheer determination. But it was, she was getting tired, and not so easy to stay courageous. So I said that maybe fearlessness would be better. Courage is a kind of a suppression of fear, and it takes a lot of energy. And there's another way to explore. Maybe, and if it doesn't occur to you, you won't look for it. But there is another option than courage or fear, and there's this thing called fearlessness. And to move towards that is to, you know, part of it is that you're moving towards the unknown, and are you sure there's something to fear there? Are you sure? Socrates was, of course, you know the story of Socrates being executed by hemlock, right? So he had to drink hemlock. And his disciples were around him in the closing hours, weeping. And he said to them, why are you weeping? Well, you're going to die. So, you seem to know something about it. Tell me what you know. The kids couldn't stop them in the tracks. None of them knew anything about. He says, well, you seem very convinced that it's going to be a bad experience. And yet you know nothing about it. Why don't you jump to that conclusion? He says, I don't know. I don't jump to the conclusion it's going to be a bad experience. His take on it was the good person has nothing to fear. There's turning towards your goodness as relief from fear. It's the quality of virtue, not the quality of courage, that will give you ease from fear. Loving kindness as well, of course. One of the great benefits of loving kindness, the Buddha says, is that one reduction of the fear of death. If the loving kindness comes up strongly enough, then somehow the realization of how long this life goes on is not important, but this to have touched that, have felt the touch of expansive love. I think universally the mind just says, well, it was worth it. And it doesn't matter that I die, but I touched something worthwhile while I was alive. And so that, now I talk like that with those people. And so, and we have moments there where, you know, it's the fear subsides. So all of this meaningful meetings, my also the meaning of just going out and answering a request by my teacher to go off and be there, and to meet with people, and to see and to reflect over this, you know, the strangeness of 20 years, change over 20 years. all works into these primary truths that the Buddha saw when he was a bodhisattva, before the primary motivations for seeking meaning in this life, that illness, aging, death. You know, Buddhism can get very abstract and so forth, but we always have to come back to this primary search for meaning in the midst of this. And we have to keep our eye on it because, in a sense, our society is like no other in terms of its ability to distract itself. We are anesthetized by television and fast food like no other generation. And it's the forgetfulness of these important facts that reduce our lives. So we have to turn that television off sometimes and reflect on these things, but not in a fearful way, but as a way of raising at least the quality of love, and maybe ultimately we can expose the Dhamma with maybe the quality of wisdom as well. Something that transcends, that gives you fuel for a search into deeper things. So when I began this talk, I had planned to talk about the conference on ecology, and I sort of got off on a different track. However, surprising how 45 minutes can go by. So that's it.